Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening to SMCC Audio Messages. We are excited to be serving you wherever you are and to be continuing to reach as many people as possible and help them take their next step in full devotion and full delight in Jesus Christ. We'd love to help you personally take your next step. You can check out all the next steps that we have available at smccutah.org/next steps. If you'd like to support the incredible mission of SMCC, one of the ways you can do that is by financially partnering with us. You can find more information about this at smccutah.org/give. If you'd like to dive deeper into what SMCC is all about, you can also subscribe to the Fully Delighted podcast. Now, on to the message for today.
All right. Well, for those of you I haven't met, my name's Trevor. I serve as one of the pastors here at SMCC. Just want to say thanks for joining us this Sunday. And I would like to get started with a question that is not exactly an easy question to settle, but I'd like us to consider it together anyways. And the question is this: what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be that which you are, that which I am? What does it mean to be human? It's not exactly the easiest question in the world to answer in a definitive and final way. And so what I did in preparation ahead of time is just what kind of did a little bit of research culturally to see what some of the broad answers to the question are. And so the first thing that popped up in my Google search was an article from the BBC that had this particular question in it. And so I was like, this is great. I'll find an article that has an answer. Hopefully it's compelling and interesting. And actually, I feel like I got catfished in a sense. It wasn't even an article. It was an ad for a documentary that was celebrating humanity, but never actually answered what it means to be human. And so I skipped across the pond digitally over to the New York Times. That was the next article that popped up in my Google search. And I thought, maybe here will be something good, something helpful. But instead, it was just a philosopher basically saying that the question itself isn't even worth answering. It just displays humanity's narcissism and how we're far more interested in ourselves than we are in any other creatures that inhabit this earth. And so that wasn't super helpful either. And so I turned to, you know, kind of my final option, the final place that anybody turns to when you're trying to draw upon the collective wisdom of the internet. I went to ChatGPT and just typed in my question there. And this is what I got. Basically, ChatGPT said, there is no one answer, but in the meantime, here are 11. And so biological characteristics, consciousness, language and communication, culture and society, all kinds of different things that actually are pretty fascinating. But there was one absence from the list. Even when you include the BBC and the New York Times, there was one kind of glaring omission from the list that I found to be particularly striking. And it's that at no point is there any mention of God. And I find that interesting because you could say, at least in my own experience, humans seem to be the only physical creature that have any interest in a being that we often call God. And yet so many of us are curious about, are interested in, are passionate about, or possess some, or have at some time possessed some belief in a being that we attach this name to. And yet at no point does that make it into the description of what it means to be human. But I think it's significant even beyond that. If I was to take it a step further, I would say that this is why the omission is striking to me, because your understanding of God shapes your understanding of what it means to be human, that these ideas are connected in ways that are significant, even regardless of what exactly you believe about God. And so I think it's more obvious in the religious sense of how these ideas are connected. For example, if you grew up within religion, you were probably given a certain understanding of God, what God's nature is, and that played into your understanding of what it meant to be human. Maybe you were even taught that at one point God was like you. And so if you do what God says to do and avoid what God says to avoid, then that means at some point you can become like God, right? That is a religious understanding of God that shapes an understanding of what it means to be human. And I think it's not always super evident in how an irreligious understanding of God can play into it, but I think it does in just as significant of a way. For example, part of what it means to be human is to possess these different desires for meaning and value and purpose and identity. Even ChatGPT, I think it's number 9. You'll see that if you check it on your notes, it talks about self-identity and purpose being part of what it means to be human, that we have these desires. And if God either doesn't exist or is at the very least so distant and muddled and unclear and unconcerned about a relationship with us, that means that these desires will not be fulfilled in a relationship with God. And so the burden for fulfilling them actually comes back to us, that we bear the ultimate weight, the ultimate responsibility of crafting a life that is good enough, that is worthy enough, that we feel satisfied in terms of our desires for identity and worth and value and purpose. And so even an irreligious perspective of God shapes an understanding of humanity that bears a very significant burden. But, you know, the truth is we could kind of go back and forth all day and all afternoon about, what different answers and what different responses to the question are of what it means to be human. But ultimately, here's the tension surrounding it. Whatever we think a human should be, we will aim for with our lives. Whatever our answer is, whether it's conscious or even subconscious, it is the thing that we are actively aiming for with our lives. And if we're wrong, it means that day in and day out, we are making decisions that are actively leading us further away from that which we are intended to be. And in doing so, you can bet that there is a high likelihood that we will make decisions at some point that will put a whole lot of mess in our lives, in our relationships, and perhaps even in the lives of those around us. And so it matters that our answer to the question is true. And so with that, I'd like to continue our series today called Contours, the Shape of John's Letters, where we've been working through the letter of 1 John, and we'll get into 2 and 3 John as well. And what we've seen so far is that throughout these letters, John has a very particular writing style that's a little bit different from what we see in some of the other New Testament writings, where in some of the other writings, you get almost like a Mona Lisa oil painting style of detail, where there is dissection and analysis and explanation of so many different ideas, where rabbit trail after rabbit trail is explored and gone down. Whereas within John's writings, you see a different style at play, where instead of dissection and analysis, he is sketching these images that he's putting in a gallery to present to his readers to give them a general understanding, an overall feel of the shape of the most important ideas of this life. And so we've seen him already talk about salvation being fellowship or intimacy or a depth of relationship with God. We've seen him sketch the shape of the Christian life and the most important features within it. Now today, as we move forward in the letter, what we'll see is that the image or the sketch that John presents is his answer to the question, what does it mean to be human? And so with that, I'd like to jump into the passage and unpack that together now. So John chapter 2, verse 28 is where we'll pick it up. Verse 28, "And now, dear children, continue in him," in Jesus, "so that when he appears, we may be confident and unashamed before him at his coming." And I want to be clear that in the context of everything that John has said, we can know that he's not saying continue in him in the sense of continue to strive to be perfect so that when Jesus comes back, you can be confident and unashamed because you are perfect. Because he's already talked about the imperfections and the missteps and how we continue to struggle with things. He's already addressed that at this point in the letter several times. So what he means is continue in him by continuing to place trust in his perfection, in Jesus's righteousness, so that at his return, you can be confident and unashamed, not because you are perfect, but because he is, and you've placed your trust in him. And so he lays that out first, and then he begins to spell out some things that happen on the other side of placing trust in Jesus like that. And this is what he says, verse 29. "If you know that he is righteous, you know that everyone who does what is right has been born of him." Born of him, speaking to this spiritual reality. He goes on to say, "See what great love the Father, the first person of the Trinity, has lavished on us that we should be called children of God." And that is what we are, that this is a reality that is real and concrete, that we are children of God. He goes on to say, the reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And all who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure. So John, he opens up at first by encouraging them to continue to place their trust in Jesus. And then he begins to spell out some of the spiritual realities of what takes place on the other side of a relationship with Jesus. He talks about being born of him and becoming children of God. And really what he's getting into unpacking is this idea that theologians refer to as regeneration. Regeneration, which is the idea that when we place trust in Jesus, we are born into a newness of life spiritually, brought from spiritual death to spiritual life, adopted into the family of God, where he is our father and we are his children. And John is saying that this is a reality that is concrete and actual, and you can see it at play in a person's life and how their life changes on the other side of this relationship. In a way, he's kind of leaning into the age-old adage of the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, but he's saying you've been born from, as a brand new apple, from a brand new tree, one that is marked first and foremost by love. And so he establishes that first, and then he begins to move into some of his contrasts. And this is where he goes next, verse 4. He says, everyone who sins breaks the law. In fact, sin is lawlessness. But you know that he appeared, Jesus appeared, so that he might take away our sins. And in him is no sins, right? Jesus lived the perfect sinless life and then died on the cross, taking the penalty for our sins upon himself. John goes on to say here in verse 6, no one who lives in him keeps on sinning. Strong language. He goes on to say, no one who continues to sin has either seen him or known him. Verse 7, dear children, do not let anyone lead you astray. The one who does what is right is righteous, just as he is righteous. The one who does what is sinful is of the devil, because the devil has been sinning from the beginning. He's beginning to set up this contrast. The reason the Son of God appeared, Jesus appeared, was to destroy the devil's work. No one who is born of God will continue to sin. That same point he made back in verse 6, because God's seed remains in them. They cannot go on sinning because they have been born of God. This reality brings about this change within their lives. He says, this is how we know who the children of God are and who the children of the devil are. Anyone who does not do what is right is not God's child, nor is anyone who does not love their brother and sister. So again, John uses, as he has throughout the entire letter, some language within this passage that is sharp, that is strong, that is very contrasting in nature. And for example, in verses 6 and 9, he makes essentially the same claim that anyone who is in Jesus or who's been born of God cannot continue to sin. And you could ask the question, is he saying that Jesus is basically a clean slate, right? That you place trust in him and you're kind of brought from guilt to innocence, moral perfection, the slate is clean. And then at that point, it's up to you, that you've got to make sure that that thing stays clean, that you don't misstep, that you don't make another mistake. Is that what John is saying? And I think, again, the evident and clear answer is no, because if that was the case, every single one of us is out of the game from the word go, because we all continue to struggle with sin. We all continue to have that difficulty within our lives. And so that's not what John is saying, but instead the idea he's trying to unpack is that habitual sin is not part of the shape of the Christian life. Habitual, ongoing, continual sin is not part of the shape of the Christian life. Now, it's been said before that if sin isn't fun, it's because you're not doing it right. And in a way, I think John is leaning into that idea here, where he's basically saying that sin doesn't continue to be fun for a Christian, because on the other side of being brought into a relationship with Jesus, it becomes all that much more clear and apparent how sin actually detracts from your life, how it robs you of your peace, how it steals you from your joy, how it takes away from your life rather than adding to it, how something that can seem fun and pleasurable in the moment is something that can actually lead to ruin in the end. How it can lead to the end of a friendship, how it can lead to the loss of a job, how it can lead to financial ruin, how it can lead to the end of a marriage, how it can lead to the end of so many things, how something that can seem good or fun or pleasurable in the moment ultimately will lead you to a place of ruin and misery. John's saying on the other side of a relationship with Jesus, that process becomes all too clear. And for that reason, it is difficult to continue to allow the things that we struggle with in our lives, that the natural thing to do is to work to get them out because it's so clear that they detract from the quality of life that we desire. And I think another way to put it is that what John is saying is that sin is the unraveling of the human shape. That sin is the unraveling of the human shape. That sin actually detracts and distorts and takes us away from that which we are intended to be. And so he lays that out sort of theoretically here in this passage. And then as he continues on, he actually presents a case study that demonstrates exactly what he's saying. This is what we see in verse 11. He says, "For this is the message you heard from the beginning. We should love one another." And he says, "Do not be like Cain." You might ask, well, who the heck is Cain? Was it someone in the community that he's saying, don't be like that guy? Well, no, it's not that. Cain is a guy that comes from a story that's recorded in Genesis chapter 4, sort of the original true crime narrative where Cain actually murders his brother. And we'll revisit that in a second, but I want to read the passage to the end. He says, "Do not be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own actions were evil and his brother's were righteous." He goes on to say, "Do not be surprised, my brothers and sisters, if the world hates you in the same way that Cain hated Abel. We know that we have passed from death to life, that we've been born into a newness of life spiritually because we love each other. Not that we have to love in order to be brought into this, but love is the thing that results from it. And in a sense, love is the evidence that indicates that this has happened. That's why he goes on to say, anyone who does not love remains in death. Anyone who hates a brother or a sister is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life residing in him." And this is how we know what love is. Right, again, he's drawing this contrast between hatred and love. And within this passage, he goes on to really sketch another image. This is how we even know what love is in the first place. And he points directly to Jesus. He says, Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, his death on the cross is what gives us the clearest understanding of what love is. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. And so John gets really practical about what this looks like. He says, "If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth." Okay. So there's a lot within that passage, but if we go back to the beginning, he starts with this case study of Cain and Abel. Again, going back to Genesis chapter 4, two brothers who present gifts to God, and Abel's is received as good, and essentially his gift brings joy and delight to God, but for some reason, Cain's doesn't. And it's not because God is petty or difficult to buy gifts for, but it's because there's something off about Cain's attitude. And you can see that because on the other side of this exchange, he sees that Abel's gift is in a sense more successful than his. And his response to that isn't to learn from it, isn't to draw a lesson, isn't to be humbled by it, but his response is to become jealous and bitter and angry with his brother. And it's not the kind of thing where he has those emotions in a moment and he processes them in a helpful way and he kind of works through them, but he continues to sit and to stew in them until they grow and they grow and they grow and they morph into something else entirely. They turn into hatred. So much so that one day Cain goes out into the fields where he knows his brother will be and where they'll be all alone. And he finds him, he finds Abel, and he kills him. He murders his own brother, his own flesh and blood. The word actually that John uses to describe this is translated murder. You could also translate it butcher. He butchers his own brother because he hates him that much. And again, John is presenting this as a case study to show what sin does to the human shape, that sin is the unraveling of the human shape. And I think what the case study presents as clearly as can be presented is that love is central to the human shape, but sin unravels it into hatred. Love is central to what we are and what we are intended to be, but sin produces hatred instead. There's this famous painting called Ecce Homo. At least that's my best guess of what it's called. It translates into "Behold the Man" by referring to the words of Pontius Pilate in reference to Jesus. And this painting was made back in the 1930s in a church in Spain, where it has adorned the walls and the inside ever since then. Really beautiful portrait of Jesus. But as with anything, over the course of time, it began to get a bit weathered, a bit worn down, a bit tattered. And so it needed to be restored. So one person took it upon herself to restore the image, to restore this particular painting. But you could say, unfortunately, she fell slightly short of the mark. This is the painting. The original's on top. I don't know if that was clear, but that. And I throw this up there just to show that sin does the very same thing to us. It makes a promise that it can deliver on what we want. Right? That if what we want is love in relationships in the context of our life, then sin promises you can get it by going this way. But what you find is that it offers less. Right? That it promises more love in relationships, but it delivers less. It promises better friendships, but it delivers less. It promises more peace and rest, yet it delivers less. In every case, it promises more and better and everything that you want, but all it has the ability to deliver is less. And I think most of us know that from experience. Because we have bought into the lie, we have made the decision, we have built our lives upon it only to find that the promises were empty. Because sin is not what we were made for. Sin is the unraveling of the human shape. And if there's one thing that's been clear from the beginning of John's letters all the way through, as he writes again and again about how God is light and love, and as we are born of him, as we become his children, the thing that changes in us, that is the very indication of ultimately what we are made for, that what John is trying to present to us is that the clearest understanding of what we are intended to be is that humans are made for love. Humans are made for love, which is why sin has a tendency to impact us in that particular area the most. That what it does is it damages our relationships. It damages our relationship with God and with each other. It impacts even our capacity for love. That sin robs us and steals us of so much because it is the unraveling of what we were intended to be. But thankfully, Jesus has made a way for us to be remade in love, to be restored in a real and accurate and true way. Through his life, through his death on the cross in our place and for our sin, and ultimately through his resurrection, through his victory over sin and over death, he has given us the chance to place our trust in him and with him and to be remade in love on the other side. And I find the words of one theologian, C.H. Dodd, the Welsh theologian, particularly helpful in unpacking really how John is saying that Jesus here, he not only extends love to us, but he gives us the clearest picture of what love is. And I think C.H. Dodd has a way of stating that very clearly, that you can see from Jesus' supreme example that love is the willingness to surrender that which has value for our own life to enrich the life of another. Love is the willingness to surrender that which has value for our own life. Jesus actually surrendered his actual life itself, entering into death in order to bring about the possibility that we could have and know and enjoy life in a life marked by love and relationships and joy. He is the supreme example of this. And yet the truth is that this is a reality in every context of life. In our romantic relationships, be they dating or engaged or married, to lean further into love is to lean further into what we're made for. In the context of our families, right? In our parenting and the way we respond to our own parents, to lean further into love is to lean further into what we're made for. In our friendships or our relationships with our coworkers or even our neighbors, to lean further into love is to lean further into what we're made for. And I think it's significant that even within this passage, the context is that John is writing to a community of people who have trusted in Jesus, a community very similar to what we have here today. And I think it's always been the case with SMCC that the church has been a context in which people have sacrificed that which has value for them in order to enrich the lives of others. And I think two of the things that you could say that we value most in this life, that I value most in this life, are my time and my money. And yet within the context of this community, people give up both regularly in order to enrich the lives of other people. And there's a relational component to that. Because on the other side, so many of us have benefited from being the recipient of other people's sacrifices. And yet what Jesus is extending to us is the invitation to do the very same thing, to be willing to lean further into love, to give up that which has value for us, to enrich the lives of others. But the curious thing is that because we are made for love, as we lean further into it, further into sacrifice, further into giving up things that actually have so much value for us, the result is not less, but more, because we're leaning into that which we were made for. That's why the bottom line is, the more we align ourselves with love, the more we align ourselves with joy.
Thank you again for listening to today's message. If you enjoyed this hopeful and helpful content, we'd love for you to subscribe and share an episode with a friend. Also, if you can please do us a huge favor and leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening on, we'd really appreciate it. We'll see you again next week.